Good evening, James McKenney, here with my Science Hour for November 17, 2022, and I'll be going through some various topics on the following shows, just kind of tying up some loose ends. This is, of course, in the year-long series of discussions of the history of my discoveries. And so, first of all, the something that is hidden in my work, there's a CD that I sell that has 110 high-resolution photographs of the American Southwest. And as you look at that, it's very interesting because the American Southwest is very old property. But what's really interesting is this, a lot of these areas that are very dry right now sported dinosaurs back, you know, millions of years ago when the dinosaurs were roaming the earth. And so it was lush tropical rainforest. And imagine the amount of foliage you would need to support a dinosaur, let alone herds of them, thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of them in an area. So you had to have tremendous growth. In fact, it's pretty clear that the CO2 content of the earth at that time was much higher. And so it gave this, but the canopy and the earth conditions were to the point where these animals, of course, got gigantic, unbelievably big animals. And the American Southwest was very different. So what you see now are the peaks of the old mountain ranges. And what happens is over time, the valleys between the mountains fills in to the point where it's flat and level. So if you're looking at, say the Andes Mountains, or you go to the Himalayan Mountains, or the Rocky Mountains also, what you find is it looks like the mountains just all of a sudden come up out of the plains. You have the plain, it might be a little bit of undulating land prior to the mountains, but you get to the mountains and they just like rise straight up out of the dirt, so to speak. Well, that's because the old mountain range continues down underground for a very long way. And these valleys have filled in. So the American Southwest looks a lot like that. But the other thing is there are some big washes. Now, these are visible from up in the sky. And, of course, these aerial photos were taken from well over 40,000 feet in the air. So you get a very good bird's eye view. Very clear photography, unbelievably, one of the rarest days when there was simply no clouds through this entire American Southwest. But there are some washes. In other words, a wash is where a big volume of water came through. And there are other places in the United States that are like that also, like the big, what are known as the Scablands in eastern Oregon, where if you go just a little bit west of the Yellowstone Park and into Oregon, it's just an area that's just been devastated by unbelievable massive flooding. If you look at the Upper Mississippi River Valley, which I did quite a bit of because I went to college in a river town, and the little private college where I went to school was nestled up on the hills overlooking the river. So you can look across 20 miles of open space, and out in the middle is the current Mississippi River. But that's not what washed these hills away. There was a tremendous just a rush of water and melting of water when the old ice cap melted. And so that most of that water went down through that channel and carved out the upper Mississippi River Valley. And it's literally, you know, 20 miles across from one side to the other. And like the river itself, we think of the mighty Mississippi River. Well, that's just a trickle compared to what was there previously. But back to the American Southwest. The American Southwest is has some washes, and these are extensive. They're very wide, and you can see where the water melted and just came down. And this would have been from, they started in around the Green River, Utah area, and the washes came down and carved out those big They're like a trough. They're just like a big trough that comes down. And when the naturalists first came to the United States and started looking, they were started going across the plains, they all reported the remnants of a great massive flood. And now I want to read something because, of course, all of this is denied by standard science. There was a lieutenant governor of Minnesota, his name was Ignatius L. Donnelly, and in 1882, he published a book. It was called Atlantis, the Antediluvian World. And listen to what it is reviewed. This is the review. It says, pseudo-archaeological book published in 1882. Pseudo-archaeological. In other words, it's not true. And now these are the major events. There was also a major change in sea levels, which we know about. The continental shelves that span the North American continent along the eastern coast, of the United States and around the Florida Panhandle and down into the Gulf of Mexico and all around the Yucatan Peninsula and then down Quintana Roo, down to Belize and Honduras, etc. The continental shelf was above water. And you can see, if you look at the underground terrain, if you have good maps, you can see the rivers that went all the way to the edge and then fell off, basically. And that is indicative of a region that was above water. And then the eastern coast of the United States would be like the eastern coast of the Hawaiian Islands, where it's the windward side and highly eroded because of the wave action. And so there's no question that the world had a great flood. And now the other thing is modern science looks for all kinds of alternative representations for this. And what they say is, oh, there was a dam. There was some kind of physical geological dam of a great body of water in Eastern Europe, and that dam broke and it flooded the Mediterranean Sea, and that's what the Great Flood was. They just want to stay away from this worldwide torrential rain, but the result is that you can see the effects, the remnants of the Great Flood, literally thousands of years later. I was on a radio show, and somebody called in and asked about the petrified wood that you find if you go out across the Dakotas. There's all these rock shops, and you have all of these gems and rocks and stones of various kinds that are resulting from water types of activity. But one thing that you'll find there are the petrified trees. These are big old petrified trees that are there and laying on the ground. But what is interesting also is it doesn't look like that's where these trees grew, that there were other locations and these were moved here by some kind of, the only method possible for geology would be water movement or glaciation movement. And where are the glaciers? They're simply not there. So the story that makes sense for all of this is once again going back to the two great earth catastrophes that we can identify related to comets, and that is the Noah's flood and the Moses event, where there was also a big influx of all you can say is pollution. It would have been hydrocarbons. They talk about the hydrocarbons, the burning naphtha, etc. But the main reason why this was taken out of the Bible is taken out of the history books. It's really not taught. They look at Ignatius Donnelly as a pseudo-archaeology book, Atlantis, the Antediluvian World. So they're talking about the prior to the Great Flood, etc., in the human populations, etc. And this was, and if you would have looked at this in the late 1800s, this was standard knowledge. This was the standard knowledge of the day, that there were these events. But as soon as you get into the 20th century, the early 1900s, etc. And as you get up, as time progresses, and all of the remnants of the American Southwest, the wood that was moved, the big forests that were literally strewn all over the place, were cleaned up, used for firewood, used, you know, the as a natural resource. And Velikovsky makes that point. He said by the time, the mid-1990s rolled around, there was no remnant left. There was nothing left. It had all been cleaned up by the human race, and towns were built, and everybody forgot about this archaeology and geology that was common knowledge back in the 1800s. So the modern ivory tower geologist who sits at his desk and doesn't, you know, who knows, maybe he's never been out in the field, then proclaims that there was no such event. But the reason also that they're proclaiming this is because they don't have a causal effect. They don't have a cause and effect relationship. They don't have a theory that explains why there would be such a flood, where it would rain all over the world for a month, over a month, 40 days, 40 nights. And once again, those are figurative numbers, but that's where my work comes in. And that's what's always been missing, even with the crackpots that try and copy my work. They miss the entire point because they don't really, they claim to support Velikovsky, but it's a joke because they don't really explain where Venus came from. There's a bunch of yo-yos out there that claim that the sun radiation hits a rock and causes it to turn into water. That's one of the theories that they're propounding on the internet, on YouTube channels, etc. It's just absolutely beyond absurd. And rocking, you know, turning into water in a comet. But see, the point is, even if it were true, play devil's advocate, even if it were true, it doesn't explain Velikovsky's situation of a comet becoming a planet. Because in that model, rock becoming water, the rock goes away eventually, whether it's, you know, it's a lot more stupid than the NASA Dirty Snowball Comet model. But there again, it goes away. It doesn't explain anything. And in their book, comets are just these little things. And if you ever went through the tail of a comet, nothing would happen. But the reality is, as if you went through the tail of a big comet like Hale-Bopp, and I did these calculations, that if we had gone, Earth had gone through the tail of Hale-Bopp through its thickest part, we would have spent around 40 days and 40 nights traversing that, and we would have had blocked sunlight. The water influx would have turned into snow and glaciers. We would have had an increase in sea level because the sea is salty, it does not freeze. And so we would have had maybe a 200, 300-foot rise in sea level. The continents that would result after that would look very different. Just take the coastline and go back to the 200-foot level. That would be the new coastline. And so, like they say, I got some property in Arizona, some beachfront property to sell you. That could possibly be the case. That's how far inland there are, in fact, maps that show the coastline given a certain rise in sea level. And so anyway, the reason that nobody talks about these events or considers them to be pseudo-archaeology or pseudoscience is because they don't have a theoretical structure to explain how this happened. And of course, that's again where my work comes in. And now it's once again trying to follow a bad vaudeville act, in a sense, where the old vaudeville, the guy would get up there, and if the people didn't like him, they would throw vegetables, tomatoes and lettuce, etc. Literally what they did. But say you were a good act and you came out on the stage and you were very good, well, the people were already hostile. They already had the tomatoes and lettuce in their hand, and they may as well just throw it at you too. When my work comes along, I followed a whole legacy of bad science from NASA, bad science from Standard Astronomy, and a lot of hatred for Velikovsky because and people like Hapgood, etc., who really had hit the nail on the head, and they made some mistakes. They didn't have everything perfect, but they had the right direction, that there were great catastrophes, and that they were related to Velikovsky's, of course, relating it to Comet Venus, which became the planet Venus. And, of course, standard science does not have any explanation for any of this. And so it's kind of like being a voice crying in the desert, because to overcome the craziness, and then you add in today, of course, the CIA creating complete disinformation programs to divert my message even further. But the people listening to this show, and of course you might be listening in 100 years from now, you might be listening to this, and by then there may be some changes in attitudes, where maybe there will be some big comets. Maybe hopefully they won't come that close to Earth, but they'll come close enough to where you get the effects, the electrical discharging, and the rain, and the sulfur dioxide when the comet connects out to the region around Jupiter, or the hydrocarbons, the rain of brimstone and fire, and then along with the Christ description that the stars will seem to fall from the sky, which would be the meteor streams. And as the meteors come in, they light the hydrocarbons, they literally, like a fire starter, and then you have the oxygen in the atmosphere that burns, so you have this burning naphtha coming down and hitting people. It's like tar burning, and the people talk about that. It burned them. It burned their skin. And so that's why, for example, the ancient Greeks were up in the caves, up in the mountains. They were there trying to survive, and they were the only ones that really survived. And they came down out of the mountains and eventually started what we call the ancient Greeks, the Platos and the Aristotles, the mathematicians. They started the culture. They built the tremendous architecture, the schools, the schooling philosophy of the complete person, spiritual, physical, mental, and with the cultural part of it, and then also logic and reasoning, and the form of government, republic form of government, which we still have today. All of this was started by the Greeks, but they came out of the mountains after surviving these horrific events. And of course, in the Donnelly, Ignatius Donnelly book, Atlantis, The Antediluvian World, the concept of Atlantis was very much taught back in the 1800s. And like I say, these were naturalists. These were people who studied nature and the physical, interpreted. They looked at what they saw and realized that something had happened. There's a story regarding Ignatius Donnelly. He was lieutenant governor of Minnesota. A farmer was out digging a well in Minnesota. This is back in the pioneer days. So the farmer is digging a well, and he gets down, 50, 75 feet, and discovers a little doll, a little figurine doll, and he brings it to Ignatius Donnelly, indicating that, that there were civilizations here. And this was not, 100 years ago when that little doll was laid down in the dirt, and this guy just happens to dig his well exactly there to find it. So there must have been could be a town or something. But all of this layering would have taken tens of thousands of years, potentially, hundreds of thousands of years, indicating that the human race had been here a long, long time ago. So, and of course, the fairy tale story that is given today in the history books, that man developed in this valley at the Tigris-Euphrates River and then expanded out from there, it's just ludicrous. It's fairy tale. Okay, and just to jump back to the topic of the 110 high-resolution photographs of the American Southwest, the CD that I have on my sales page, And if you go through these, you will find those big washes that come down through the American Southwest. And it's right now it's just gravel, and of course it's very dry there, so these washes stay there. But what's interesting is you can see these same effects on Mars. You see these big washes where there must have been large volumes of water, and as the planet changed during the comet encounter, these washes were formed, where large volumes of water just rushed down a certain area, and everything in its path is gone. So you'll find little rivers, you'll find other geological features that are just washed away in these regions where this water came through. Okay, so switching gears a little bit to talk about some other theoretical issues. And this is an important concept, and so it runs throughout my work. I've talked about, last week I talked about the hurricanes and the cyclonic storms, the tornadoes, the waterspouts, the tornadoes on the sun, etc. Dust devils on Mars, and relating cyclonic storms, etc., to a single phenomenon being the vertical electric field and the discharge of that vertical electric field. Okay, so now I want to talk about cloud formations, and so this takes on a number of different, phenomenon. And so if you have a vertical electric field, I have to explain, first of all, that when you're dealing with a capacitor, the standard construction of a capacitor, and this is the simplified version, is you have a positive plate, you have a negative plate, and typically the positive charges are fixed. They're in an atom, they're ionized atoms, they're in a structure, they're hooked together. And in the outer space, or in the ionosphere of Earth, they're in a plasma form. And so anyway, but they still have a positive charge. And the negative charges could be ions also, but typically they're electrons. And that happens in the non-uniform electric field of the sun. You have the solar corona, which is primarily electrons around Earth's atmosphere. You have similar conditions above the equator. You have the electron field that is moving in a westerly direction around the Earth, etc. And so, but primarily electrons. And so the dynamics of a capacitor in nature is very similar to a capacitor in the laboratory where you have physical plates. But the thing I want to talk about here is the material that's in between the plates. And if you make a capacitor, a lot of times you want to increase the amount of charge you put on that capacitor. In a typical capacitor, say you made one in outer space, it was a perfect vacuum, or you did this in a vacuum chamber, you have a perfect vacuum in between, and as you build up charge at a certain point, the plates will start to discharge. There'll be so much charge that the electrons can overcome the surface potential of the metal that they're in and then start moving towards the positive plate, or if it's in outer space, there's basically no resistance, and so the charges can start moving immediately. However, in outer space, you need a source of energy to maintain that capacitor. And that's where the solar wind comes in, the fusion in the sun's surface, etc. But in Earth's atmosphere, this is what I'm trying to get at, or in the atmosphere of Jupiter or Saturn or other planets like Mars, etc., what you have is a gaseous material. We call it atmosphere. Okay, so that atmosphere has a dielectric property, and the dielectric property is such that it blocks the electric fields because of the orientation of the dielectric atoms and molecules, etc. They orient the molecules so as to reduce the effect of the electric field of the capacitor, which allows you to put more charge on the plates. And it also blocks the electricity from flowing from one plate to the other. So the Earth's atmosphere is acting as a dielectric. And it's a very good dielectric, which allows the capacitor of Earth, the vertical electric field of Earth, to store up a lot of energy. Okay, so how does this energy then release? How is it released and cause weather systems down in what we call the troposphere? Okay, so the reason I'm talking about this is because it's fundamental to almost everything we see in terms of weather. If it were not for this vertical electric field and capacitor, we would not have clouds, and we would not have wind, we would not have weather. The other thing that happens with these current sheets is they were coupled in a magnetic field. Okay, so the protons and the ions, the positively charged ions, move in one direction and the electrons move in the other direction, and they create belts. For example, we have the Van Allen belts that surround Earth. You have an electron belt and a proton belt, and these are relativistic. They are moving at near the speed of light. So high levels of radiation belts surrounding Earth. But they also have, they are part of our magnetic field that actually protects us. So scientists that are studying, for example, the Van Allen belts, they realize that all of a sudden there's a big influx of electrons into the electron belt, or a big influx of protons into the proton belt. Well, where does that come from? And all of a sudden, magically, sometimes these are depleted. What's going on here? What causes that? Well, they don't have any explanations in standard science. So the end result is that, for example, one of the big issues with going into outer space is space radiation. And these, I heard, unfortunately, the other day, Elon Musk talking, who is a person who wants to go into outer space, and he has no clue about what causes space radiation and what the dangers are. His explanation was that you would put a body of water, a container of water, between the astronauts and the sun, and that would block radiation. He has absolutely no clue that it's the discharge of the spacecraft, the spacecraft discharging the electrical batteries, which causes high, or going through the Van Allen belts, for example, where there are relativistic protons and electrons. When they hit metal in the spacecraft, they create X-rays, and I don't care how much water you put in on the sunward side, it's not going to block the X-rays from basically frying the astronauts and creating a lot of damage in the spacecraft itself. So as we move into the future, and that's one of the big issues I want to talk about also in a few minutes here, but just wrapping up this topic of the importance of understanding, and this is something that nobody understood before my work. This is why the Russian scientists loved my work, because they were atmospheric scientists. They had all of these phenomena occurring, and they had no idea why this was happening. Okay, so back to the physical description of the dielectrics. This is so important because it occurs in the sun's atmosphere, Jupiter, Saturn, which are small stars. But there is a dielectric effect there also. And that's what, when the electrical discharges occur, that's what helps provide the energy, the stored energy that is released in the discharges. And that's what kicks off the fusion in the solar atmosphere. And of course, the sun's atmosphere has to be resupplied with hydrogen. And that is an effect that happens when the sun discharges the galactic capacitor, which is the same process. This process comes over and over and over again. But an essential part of this occurring, and in the galactic atmosphere itself, in the nucleus of the galaxy, you have the same process where you have fusion, ongoing fusion in the galactic, the central star, so to speak. And all of these processes work the same. But one of the essential parts of this entire concept is where you have the separation of charge, and it's maintained because of the dielectric in the atmosphere. And so getting back to Earth's atmosphere, that's the simplest one to understand. Jupiter is much more complicated. But Earth's atmosphere, you typically look up and you see a clear sky. You might see some clouds, etc. Now that's what I want to get into now, is what happens when you have a volcanic plume. I talked about a fire on the desert. If you go out to the desert where you have a propensity for dust devils, you light a fire. And that fire starts to send a heat signal or a heat plume vertical. And all of a sudden, that's enough to discharge the vertical electric field locally. And you get a little tornado coming up from the fire. And what's causing that? You're discharging, you're breaking down that dielectric. Okay, let me give you another example. In my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book, I have a photograph of a volcano. It's in Italy, and I forget, I forget which mountain it is. But anyway, there's a photograph there on a clear blue sky day. So this is up in the mountains, you know, above the cloud line, and it's very dry. And out of the volcano is a tornado just sitting there, spinning. Well, what's causing that? Well, what happens is that volcano is like a finger sticking up in the sky, and so it's at ground potential because it's connected to the ground down below. So you're extending that mountain like a finger up into the dielectric, and there's heat coming up off of the caldera at the top of the volcano, and that is changing the dielectric property of the air above it. And so it's causing a discharge of the vertical electric field, and that's what causes the tornado. So you have ionization of air at the caldera. Those ions want to move upwards. When they move upwards, they start to spin because it's like water going down the drain in the bathtub. It's the same thing, except it's going up, and it's the same Coriolis force that causes that spinning action. And it's moving up the columns. That's the tornado. And so that's why, for example, at the base of a cyclonic storm, you have a vacuum because it's sucking the air up the column. That's an electrical current. That's what's causing that. And this is because you're breaking down the vertical electric field in the dielectric, and that's what's very important. Okay, let's look at a hurricane. The same issue. When you have a current, you have a thunderstorm system that's coming across Africa, the plains of Africa, and they come out over the western coast of Africa that comes out over the ocean. And prior to that, the discharge of the vertical electric field was shorting out to ground because it was over the land of Africa. As this storm system moves out over the water, then what's happening? You have a storm system, and if you look at the clouds, which I've done hundreds of times with weather, satellite weather systems, etc., they're billowing up. And this is, once again, you would not even have clouds if it were not for the vertical electric field. It's similar to a cloud chamber where you have a capacitor, and you have water vapor, which forms clouds in the chamber because of the vertical, because of the capacitor electric field, and then high charge or high energy charged particles come through there, like cosmic rays or protons, etc., and ionize the water vapor and leave little tracks. It's one of the very early methods of detecting radiation. And so you can tell the type of radiation, etc., in a cloud chamber. Well, the atmosphere is doing the same thing. So as the storm system, as the cloud systems move out over the ocean, you no longer have the electrical connection to ground because the water is not a good conductor, but you do have ionization going on down at the level of the air right above the ocean floor. So that ionized air wants to go up and it defines one column, and where does it actually form the eye of the hurricane? If you look from the side of the cloud, you would find the point that's the tallest cloud, the tallest point on the top of the cloud. That's where it starts to discharge more than any other place in the cloud. And so that's where the column forms, and that's where the eye of the storm forms. That's where the hurricane eye forms. And once again, it's a cyclonic storm. And what happens? Why does the water cool on the ocean? The water cools because the air is forms a circular rotating pattern. It evaporates the water from the surface of the ocean and cools the ocean a little bit. And the morons, the complete morons in the meteorological world, think that the cooling of the ocean is what causes the hurricane. And like I say, it's an example. Here's an example I always use. If you had a car, an automobile, and you had somebody the first time they ever saw this automobile driving down the road, and you said, "What's powering this automobile? What makes it go down the road?" And the person looks, and this is actually, I have had people answer this, that they look at the car and they think, well, the exhaust pipe goes out the back and there's like exhaust coming out the back, so that must be what pushes the car down the road. But if you went up to the exhaust pipe and you measured the exhaust coming out of that little tube, you'd say, well, the car weighs 2,000 pounds and the amount of exhaust coming out is minuscule. It's not enough to make the car go down the road. There must be some other process going on here. Well, it's the same thing with this cooling of the ocean causing a hurricane. It's the amount of energy of the cooling is absolutely minuscule. It's even an example much more extreme than the car example, where you have probably trillions of times the amount of energy in a hurricane as you have from cooling of the water. The water cooling, as I said, is a result of when the ionized air starts spinning, it causes wind, it blows over the ocean, it evaporates the water from the surface of the ocean and causes a little bit of surface cooling. Because when you evaporate water, that's the effect. It has the effect of cooling. And so that's what's going on. That's how twisted and topsy-turvy science is today. And then they say, oh, well, if there's a higher salt content in the water, then it takes more to evaporate the water, and so therefore you get a bigger hurricane. Oh my goodness, these people are so retarded. And this is fields. This is the entire meteorological community. It's baffling. It's baffling to see this. So many educated people that just don't have a clue at all. But there again, that's tier two science. But the real story is that the cloud at the very top point, and you can see this vertically also from the satellite photos, because the uppermost points of the clouds, you can see them like churning upwards and bubbling upwards as the cloud forms, as these currents rise up in the cloud systems. And then when the current breaks through, then you see the eye start to form and the eye starts to spin and open up, etc. And that, by the way, is how you control a hurricane, is with a laser satellite. You put the beam down on the edge of the eye and cause a greater discharge on that side of the eye of the hurricane, and the hurricane moves in that direction. And so anyway, that's how you control. So you can take a laser satellite, and we've seen them do this. Once they got the satellites up there, they would take a hurricane and move it north and east and south and west and make it just move in circles, experimenting with the laser satellite. So the hurricanes like Katrina and just dozens of other hurricanes were manipulated by laser satellites, and of course to cause major destruction. Recently, about a year ago, there was a series of hurricanes that came in between Texas in Louisiana, in the rice growing area, grows something like 40% of the rice in the world is grown in that area. And these hurricanes came in one after the other during the harvest season to destroy, to break up the production of rice in those regions. And also you could tell the way you tell the hurricane is being manipulated is that there's a stretching of the eye in that area, because the eye should be perfectly circular. It should not have a stretched area on one side. The other thing you could tell is that the hurricanes would gain energy as they made landfall. And typically a hurricane, once it starts coming up that continental shelf, especially where there's a very big one in the Gulf of Mexico, that hurricane would start to lose energy and drop its water offshore. But that's not what these did. These kept building up energy and building up energy, and that's because they were being manipulated. Okay, so anyway, back to the concept of the dielectric in the vertical electric field, keeping it there. Let's come back, for example, to the Tesla towers, what Nikola Tesla was doing with his Wardenclyffe and Colorado Springs experiments. Once again, this is something Tesla was aware of. He was aware of the dielectric properties of the atmosphere. He was aware of the vertical electric field, but he had no idea what caused it. That's where my work came in and extended what Tesla did, was to discover the source of the voltage of the vertical electric field. Where does it come from? How is it related to the currents that are driven in the solar system by the solar wind, which has an excess current of protons, which creates the overall discharge of the capacitor of the solar system, which Earth is discharging just like the other planets. And this is the source of the vertical electric field, because if you did not have some kind of external, very serious ongoing source of energy, the vertical electric field of Earth would not last very long at all. In a matter of maybe a day or two, it would be completely depleted. So it has to be an ongoing process, just like the rings of Saturn, just like the electrical discharges between Dione and Saturn, or Io and Jupiter, or Mercury and the Sun, etc. So these are effects that are the result of a dielectric in the atmosphere. So what Tesla was doing with his Wardenclyffe Tower is it was hooked up to inside the building down at the base of the tower. He had basically a Schmitt trigger, which is just an on-off trigger. That's all it is. Fancy name for an on-off switch that's controlled, but it's an electronic switch. And it has to be built different than, say, the switch in your wall for your lights when you turn the lights on. It's different, but it also can be an electronic switch. But what happens is when you touch that switch, all of a sudden there's a tremendous surge of electrical current, and then you have that hooked up to a capacitor inductor circuit, which then changes that into a very high voltage, and you put that very high voltage onto the Tesla tower, the big dome at the top that had all the fingers sticking out, these metal fingers sticking out. And what did they do? They're like an antenna, and what they're doing is they're changing between plus and minus millions of volts. And this is part of the amazing design of the Tesla tower. The Wardenclyffe tower was at a set frequency. And that's why I always say Nikola Tesla had some help, I think. He was a genius. This guy did things that nobody else could imagine. But it would be the equivalent of the Wright brothers building a 747 jet on the first time around and making it fly across the ocean. That's the equivalent of what Tesla did with the Wardenclyffe Tower. So it makes me believe, and I don't have proof, it makes me believe, I talk about this in my Atlantis to Tesla book, makes me believe that Tesla had a source of information, and my guess is that he got that information from the library of the Vatican Library, of which his father was a curator. When he was a kid, growing up, he was a physicist, a very good one, an extremely good one, one of the best in history. And I've told this little story before. When they asked Albert Einstein what it felt like to be the greatest physicist in the world, Einstein said, go ask Tesla. And he really meant it, because Tesla did so many amazing things. Einstein was very good too, but they were on a par. Of course, they had different avenues of study. But Tesla was, in terms of practical applications, was, you know, amazing. He lit up the Chicago, remember the 96 Chicago World's Fair? I forget the year, I think it was like late 1800s. And Tesla built all of the circuitry for the Chicago Fair. And it was an amazing spectacle that people came from all around. And what's interesting is that the king and queen of Hawaii had electricity in their palace in Honolulu in the earlier than the Chicago Fair. In the 1800s, they already had electrical wiring and circuitry and lights in the palace in Honolulu. And it's one of the great tragedies of the 1800s is the destruction of the Hawaiian people, who had amazing culture. Ships came from around the world with royalty and dignitaries to visit the Hawaiian Islands and the king and queen. And of course, they were disrupted and Hawaii made into a state. And of course, in World War II, Hawaii was a chess piece in World War One, and World War II, and by then, the king and queen of Hawaii had been thoroughly reduced. And then I forget which year it was, probably in the 1950s when Alaska and Hawaii became states, which was another railroading process. But the point is that the king and queen of Hawaii, previous to the Chicago Fair, which Tesla lit up in the late 1800s. Prior to that, the king and queen of Hawaii had electricity. But back to Tesla and the Tesla Tower. So what he was doing was he had a controlled frequency, which was the resonant frequency of the dielectric of our atmosphere. Now that's kind of a mouthful. So what that means is the dielectric molecules in Earth's atmosphere. And these could be nitrogen, they could be oxygen or other compounds in the atmosphere, have a slight dipole, an inherent dipole. And when they're put into an electric field, they also induce a dipole. So this is a complicated, would be a complicated theoretical problem, but you can measure the resonant frequency of the atmosphere. And so what happens with the Tesla tower, by changing it, the voltage plus and minus at the resonant frequency of the atmosphere, you get the ions flipping back and forth. And it's literally, as I say in the Atlantis to Tesla book, like drilling a hole, an electrical hole through the dielectric of the atmosphere. And what happens when you do that? All of the electrical current comes down that channel, just like as if you had a mountaintop volcano, volcanic caldera, or if you had a cloud system that stuck up, you know, 15, 20,000 feet up into the air and was basically bubbling upwards in that uppermost finger that comes up from the cloud, from the cumulonimbus clouds that are boiling upwards in the atmosphere. All of a sudden, you get an electric connection with the vertical electric field, with the ionosphere, and the current starts to flow, and the ionospheres, which are down at the sea level, start to move up the column. You connect the circuit because of the clouds forming in the middle of the dielectric. That's what Tesla was doing with the Wardenclyffe Tower. It's what he was doing with the Colorado Springs Towers. And then he would feed the electricity at the resonant frequency of the ground, which he also knew because you could measure it. And so that's how he was delivering the power, not like the modern story where they say he was going to deliver power with the Wardenclyffe Tower. No, that's absurd. That's not what Tesla was going to do. That's not what he was doing. He was collecting the energy, and then there was a little trick he pulled on Westinghouse, that when Westinghouse bought for $4 million Tesla's technology for the generators, the physical generators of electricity using coal, or also they put one in at Niagara Falls where they had the waterfalls. That was originally a Tesla project also. But the technology that Westinghouse purchased, Tesla sold that, and so Tesla did not have a way to generate electricity. But he knew about the vertical electric field, and once Westinghouse realized, and J.P. Morgan, who was funding Tesla's Colorado Springs project, once they found out that he had a way of tapping into some kind of magical electrical source in the atmosphere, they went and tore it down. They tore down the Wardenclyffe Tower, and this was in 1917, in the middle of World War One. So that's another interesting aspect of Tesla's work that you can understand from my understanding of Tesla's work, which is what I did. I brought understanding to what Tesla was doing, is that he had the Wardenclyffe Tower torn down in the middle of World War One, 1917, and his project that he was taking to England, when the day he died, literally, he had offered his war defense product to the Pentagon, the United States, and they turned it down. They said, no, we're not interested. He said, I can build technically a wall so that no airplanes or anything can fly into the United States. And I explained that in my paid cast, in my education package. I have a whole lecture on the war products, the defense of war products, or military products, I should say, not war products, but military products, defensive products that Tesla had proposed. And based on, I can talk about it here a little bit also, it's based on the Wardenclyffe Tower. And what he does is he sets up a series of Wardenclyffe Towers that can be activated upon the approach of airplanes coming across the coastline. And you activate these towers, and what they do is they're at the edge of the breakdown of the vertical electric field. And when the planes fly through the vertical electric field, it's like the bug killer. Zap, 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 zap. It would knock all those planes out of the air, and there would be no possibility for them to fly through. And that was what Tesla was taking to England at the time. He was leaving, like the song, leaving on a jet plane. Well, of course, there were no jets back then, but Tesla had packed up his bags, and he was on his way out to take his invention to England to sell it, who needed desperately some kind of defense system like this, because the Germans were coming across the English Channel, still in that time frame, 1943. And magically, Tesla dies that day. And the story is that George Bush Sr. was a young CIA operative at that time, was part and parcel to the confiscation of the records of Tesla. And apparently the word is also, I can't confirm this personally, that some of the records of Tesla ended up with Donald Trump's uncle, who was a physicist who worked, I don't know all of the details, but I've heard that that's actually a true story. But I don't think all of the paperwork went to Donald Trump's uncle. There was a lot which was confiscated, which I think had been kept secret. And so you have to ask yourself, with such a good defense system, why was it never implemented to defend the United States? That's an open question. Okay, so but back to the physics of what Tesla was doing. He was doing the same thing as clouds do, as volcanic calderas do up in the air, the same thing that campfires will do out on the open prairie or the open desert where there are dust storms forming. breaking down that vertical electric field by some means, causing the current to flow to some degree. And that was the other thing, is Tesla had the ability to control that. Remember the story that when my Atlantis to Tesla book came out, a number of weeks after that, the U.S. military developed a project up in Canada, west of Ottawa, and it was an experimental Tesla tower, and they didn't really understand what they were doing. They took the power from one of the Ottawa nuclear power plants, and it was not enough to power up, because this takes a tremendous amount of power once you start drilling through the atmosphere with a Wardenclyffe-type tower. It takes a tremendous amount of energy. Well, they didn't have enough energy locally, and of course that nuclear power plant was supplying the local population with electricity, so they were just using some extra. They needed more power, so they asked the United States if they could draw power off the Northeast power grid of the United States, which they did, and they finally were able to break through to the vertical electric field of Earth. And when that charge came down, it blew out the reactor in Ottawa and backed up seven nuclear power plants on the east coast of the United States. And that's where the power surge, it knocked out automobile electronics, a tremendous surge. It knocked out electronics from businesses, computers. The whole Northeast Corridor was destroyed electronically. And the ultimate explanation from the Atomic Energy Commission and the federal government, the Department of Energy, was that a squirrel's tail fell across a wire in Ohio, and that's what caused the great Northeast power outage. What really happened is they had built this Tesla experimental tower, did not know what they were doing, had no idea, and took out the whole Northeast United States corridor and electrically in a flash. Okay, so an interesting set of topics in this show. I'll continue next week with some more discussion, but this week I had to explain about that vertical electric field and its most important dielectric, the air, and how that contributes to the, you know, the hurricanes, the tornadoes, what Tesla was doing, how the fusion works on the sun because of that same principle. If it weren't for the dielectric, none of that would work. Remember my webpage, pages, plural, jmccwaterfilters.com, where you can use the coupon code JMCC for a 10% discount on any purchases there. And the other webpage, the traditional webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.